Simply. This is she, and I want to thank you for joining us today. We have Kevin Muno joining us today from Montando Farms. He is going to educate us about farming, his upcoming project in Southern California, and a little bit more. So without further ado, let's dive in with Kevin. And I wanted to welcome you to one. I thought we could start out our conversation about Montando Farms and really your methodology, what you were just sharing with me before we got on the air, of how you plan to bring a really beautiful, sustainable, and regenerative methodology to farming in Southern California.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Suzanne. I'm very excited to speak with you today and share with you a little bit more about Montando Farms, a new model for California agriculture. Montando Farms is really trying to set out and prove a new regenerative model successful here in our dry land Mediterranean climate. Part of our two main strategies really are mimicking nature and harvesting as much water in the landscape as possible. And so we do that really through two methodologies. The water management strategy is coming from a lot of wisdom out of Australia through the key line design management system, which really is kind of a fancy word for a methodology for designing a landscape to not only harvest water through earthworks in the soil, but also through placement of different elements in a broad acre farming landscape. And so the idea is the more connections you can have between the different elements in your landscape, the more efficient your farm's going to be and the less cost you're going to have in running it. And so that's our water management strategies. And then our mimicking nature philosophy comes a lot out of the work of Mark Shepherd from Restoration Agriculture. He's a big agroforestry guy, and that's a big common accepted term from USDA, which outlines different design strategies as well, from things like windbreaks to forest farming to silvopasture, which is integrating animals into tree system farming practices. And so we kind of look at the oak savanna of California as our ecological model, and we substitute economic species for those elements that would kind of occur naturally in our environment here in California and grow an abundance of food. And I know that was kind of a long explanation, but hopefully not too long.
No, it's beautiful. And great. If you can educate the listeners a little bit about what is ideal, because we're living in a time and space on planet Earth where there's been so much migration, so not only with food but also with people that might have needs from a different culture or region, just because their body actually physically craves it. If you're from East India or you're East Indian, you're going to crave some of those things if you're all of a sudden on the North American continent. So if you can just educate the listeners about what really our landscape really likes to yield traditionally, and what it can provide.
No, that's a great question, Suzanne. And I think California is just such a beautiful landscape. I mean, there is a lot of oak savanna traditionally, which is a very abundant ecosystem, with the oak tree being the main staple. You know, these very giant, large oak trees, whether it's the coast live oak or the valley oak. It's the predominant overstory crop, and that yields a lot of acorns. And traditionally as well, the native peoples, whether it be the Chumash, kind of in the Santa Barbara, Thousand Oaks area, actually where I grew up, 805 area code, or the Kumeyaay Indians down here in San Diego where I currently live, about 40-50% of their diet has been documented to be from the acorn. And so thinking about where most of our calories come from is an important question. Currently today, Most of our calories throughout the world are coming from three or four main crops. It's corn, soy, wheat, and rice. And with a lot of those plants, they're annual in nature, meaning you have to till the soil or flood irrigate or, you know, do very large agricultural, you know, tillage of the soil, which is very detrimental to our soils and burns up organic matter and doesn't mimic nature very closely. And that's why we've had to bring in outside elements to suffice for that. So the acorn, bringing it back to the traditional peoples, was a big part of their diet, as well as animals. And so we will have animals as well and bring those back into the landscape and mimic nature with our animals as well. We use the holistic management Alan Savory model to rotationally graze and mob stock animals, mimicking the herds of old that used to do this same thing, protect themselves from predators by bunching and moving constantly because they would foul the ground that they're moving on. And so by mimicking this bunching pattern in our agricultural landscape, we, Alan and about 40 million acres across the globe have really been able to refurbish grasslands and recharge agricultural soil. So the acorn being the staple, lots of meats, kind of grass-fed meats, doing it the right way, humanely treated, local sources. Those are the main products we're kind of looking at bringing back as this staple food crop, what needs to be the staple food crop of the future.
Right. And if you can talk a little bit more about what happens when we talk about grass-fed meats, when we allow animals to actually be more in a holistic pattern, how that can change the resonance of A, for them, and then also mm-hmm. for the land that they're on, and also mm-hmm. for what we consume.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think when most people, you know, think of grass-fed meat today, they just think, okay, yeah, it ate grass its whole life, and it wasn't pump full of corn like most of the cows are today, and that's definitely a step forward. I mean, cows aren't meant to eat grains, and so they're meant to be raised on grass their whole lives. However, if you just throw the cows out there in one large area and they have selection to any plants that they want, then they're going to eat all the chocolates first. They're just like us. they're going to eat the good plants first and then let bad ones kind of overgrow, overrest, and decay. And so the health of your grasses, the health of your plants, when you do a continuous kind of grazing plan like that, especially in dry areas where we are, your forage material will decline. And so through the holistic management process, and what, you know, Alan Savory has put together, you really, the key to the whole system is mimicking nature and getting these animals to get in large bunches, which has a few effects on the grasslands. First of all the plants now become evenly grazed, and no plants become overrested and just oxidize to the sun. They all become evenly grazed, and then they have sufficient enough time to rest before you bring the animals back into that same area so that they are now fully recovered, so they're not being overgrazed and they're not being overrested, and it's a much healthier plant. And so the much healthier plant will bring better nutrition to the animal, which will decrease your cost of any sort of thing that you were using, whether it be an antibiotic or supplemental nutrition, to feed that animal, and it'll be much, much healthier for it. And the animal appreciates that because it gets fresh forage material every time you move them. They're outside, they're in the sun, they get more omegas in their diet, more beta carotene, all of these improved benefits of rotating. And your soils will improve, so the minerality of your soil and the nutrition content in your soils will make for healthier plants, and that just makes for a healthier whole.
Beautiful. Yeah. And then if you can talk a little bit about that six-layer structure that you have on your website, it's beautifully done.
Thank
and
you.
What, with your focus that you've shared, what you feel is possible. It's really started, you know, you guys build out your farm and can build out more and more farms, how mm-hmm. it can really benefit people here in California for food in a different way than we've looked at in the past.
Well, I think the whole idea with our six-layer structure is really just looking at savanna landscapes and trying to mimic that. And so in a savanna landscape, there's different layers. For the oak savanna here in California, we have our overstory layer, which is the oak, but then there's smaller trees, like the olive is actually native to San Diego County down here, and so that's a mid-story layer tree. And then there's a shrub layer, which for us, we're going to plant hazelnuts, which is also, there's a native variety of hazelnuts to California. And then there's your kind of bramble layer, which can be your cane fruits and your berries and your golden currants, which also are native species, but we're taking the agricultural version and we're substituting that in the landscape. And then you have your vining layer, which will grow up, your medium-sized to canopy layer trees, whether that be the oak or the olive. And then you have your grasses that grow up in between the savanna landscape. And so the savanna, if you look throughout the world, is the most photosynthetically productive biome in the world. And most people are like, well, what about the rainforest? And well, if you actually look at the rainforest, most of the photosynthesis is actually occurring at the canopy layer. And so, you know, if you fly over it, it's a pretty, you know, flat canopy. There's not a lot of undulations or three-dimensional structure, whereas in a savanna, it's very three-dimensional. It goes all the way up to the tallest canopy layer trees and then all the way down to the grasses. And the grasses are really the driver of the system. They are allowed to still get sun, and then the big herbivores eat those grasses. So traditionally, only 10,000 years ago, we had mastodons roaming most of the areas of California, large, large herbivores being supported by these savanna landscapes. And so we're trying to mimic that. It's the most productive agricultural system out there today. We've shown that it can produce twice the amount of human food calories per acre compared to monoculture systems, whether that's, you know, just a corn and soybean field or whether that's just a rice field. I mean, we've shown that through stacking these different layers, we can get more calorie production with less inputs going into the system. And if you look at the nutrition per acre too, I mean, if you're just going to eat, you know, you compare side by side, you know, an acre of corn and then an acre of our savanna landscape perennial system, and the nutrition per acre is much more than just two times. It's, you know, 10 times, because you're getting the minerals from the different fruits, you're getting the proteins from the animals, you know, the very healthy mineral content of their meat, and just a variety of abundance of nutritional benefits. And so what that means for California, I mean, we have a very, you know, big chance to create some change in how we think of local food and how we think of, you know, feeding other, you know, I mean, we ship most of our food out, you know, to the country. I think there's, you know, a statistic out there that says about 11% of the country gets their food from California. So, I mean, we do things at a large scale here, and our oak savanna agroforestry system that we want to do is a scalable system. It can be done on 10 acres. It can be done on 1,000 acres. And so I think it has big impacts for how we think about food here in California, both on the small local scale but on the broad scale as well.
Beautiful. And yeah. If you can share a little bit about that calorie production, which I love those words, and
yeah.
how you, just as a consumer of food, think of your calorie consumption differently, working mm-hmm. in this arena, and where you've noticed the difference. Because if you're thinking about growing these things, I imagine your diet is somewhat reflective of some
yes.
of those things.
Yeah, no, definitely. I grew up, well, I started really getting passionate about my nutrition in college. I was an athlete at University of San Diego for 5 years. I played baseball there. And so as I was kind of researching different ways to eat, I was, you know, coming across different diets, and the paleo diet spoke to me just because, like a lot of what I'm doing now, it kind of looks at our evolutionary, you know, way that we have kind of evolved to eat. And it's a diet based largely on kind of nature, on what grows in nature most easily. And nature is comprised of about 90% perennials, if you actually look at, you know, nature. And perennial, for the listeners who don't know, you know, a plant that lives longer than 1 year. Most of the calories that we get today are plants that are annual plants that have to be planted every season. And so my diet has definitely shifted more towards a perennial diet, which is, you know, nut crops, nut flowers, lots of grass-fed, very, very nutritionally dense meats, lots of berries, lots of vegetables that are grown in good, you know, healthy soils from local farms. And so I think for the average consumer, that's an important question, is what are you supporting with your decision to eat? You know, are you eating, you know, where truly is your food coming from? And so I think for someone who wanting to, you know, eat better and live healthier, and also know that their food's coming from a good place where it's actually building soil and building community, then you really have to look at where a lot of your grain products are coming from, and are they grown in a healthy way? And it's been really hard for me to eliminate wheat, I'll tell you that for sure. I'm a big bread eater, but, you know, I still have it on occasion, but still, you know, I'm trying to really focus on, you know, a lot of nut flours and nut breads and make my own breads and, you know, really kind of shift my eating patterns towards a more perennial based diet until I can find a farm that grows wheat in a way much like Masanobu Fukuoka from One Straw Revolution, where he's actually returning a lot of the straw material and organic material back into the soil, where he's building soils. And I don't know too many small scale wheat farms that are doing that. And so I guess that's probably a pretty good snapshot into how I've changed my eating patterns based on my agricultural system.
Nice. And also, if you can share a little bit about the economics of this farming system and how it can be advantageous for us in the sense that there's not a lot of depletion and rest time maybe, or regeneration time.
There's a quote by one of my mentors that says, you know, most of conventional agriculture today answers two questions, really. How do I keep this thing alive that wants to die, or how do I kill this thing that wants to live? And so the more we can get away from that methodology, I think the economics of farming are going to get a lot better. With mimicking nature, the cost greatly decrease on your farm landscape. Nature has been growing perennial staple food crops on its own without any outside human inputs for thousands of years. You know, we look at the oak tree, we look at, you know, these different food crops that just grow naturally in nature. And so when you design your farm landscape after that, once you get these perennials established, eventually over time your costs will come down because you're barely doing anything. You're just doing the bare minimum to keep these plants alive, and the genetic winners will come forth and produce and become a very productive crop for you that requires a lot of less inputs. So the more you can organize each element in your farm to work with each other rather than against it. So an example is grasslands have been shown to do much better in a dappled shade environment. So by creating a savanna type of landscape where there's trees intermixed with your grasses, the grasses actually perform better because they're in a dappled shade of 40 to 60%, and so they'll grow taller and grow more nutritious if they're in a dappled shade environment because they can only photosynthesize throughout the day for a certain amount of time. So that's one example. And then, you know, through harvesting water in the landscape and recharging the groundwater table through these earthworks and swales that we do with the key line system, that reduces your water cost right there, which probably for farmers in California, especially now, is probably the highest cost. And so the more we mimic nature, the more we can capture water on our property, over time our costs will reduce and our inputs will come up because we're creating more biodiversity in the landscape. And it might not be, you know, compared to if we're growing, you know, vegetables in our alleyways, we're probably not going to grow as much of that vegetable as, you know, a monoculture, you know, carrot farmer or monoculture eggplant farmer is doing. But in terms of total site yield, we're going to grow much more food because every niche is being filled compared to the monoculture farm.
Nice. And yeah. If you can share a little bit about vegetables since you brought them up.
Yes.
Your plan for them, if any. Sounded like you have a plan for them.
They'll be in there for sure. They're important, actually. Yeah.
So if you can share a little bit about where they fit into the equation how being... You almost made me cry when you said trying to kill the plant that wants to live. You know, and you see that so much, being I live in California too, and different parts of the North American continent where people just like pillage plants, like, you know, it's like changing a shirt or something. And it makes me really sad. I have such a deep relationship with my plants and my garden. So if you can share a little bit about that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, no, definitely. We will grow vegetables in the alleyways of our agroforestry system. So if you go on my website, if you Google alleyway cropping, it's essentially growing annual crops in between rows of trees. Mm. And so for an agroforestry farm, especially in the early years, this is important because a lot of your early cash flows will be come from the annual vegetables that you grow on your farm, because they can, you know, grow and be sold within, you know, 6 months. And so so the way that we grow them is in between the trees. We treat them a lot like our trees in how we put them out there, and we do as much as we can to really keep them alive. We do weeding, you know, we'll do the general soil building practices. We'll harvest the vegetables, but then we'll also rotate where those vegetables are being grown. So, you know, after harvest season, when there's no more crops left on the plant, instead of really, you know, kind of pulling them up and, you know, tilling the ground again and, you know, going through with the tractors and spraying, you know, pesticides so the weeds don't come up, or fertilizer, we'll range our animals in between there. And so the animals will come in, they'll eat the leftover, you know, plant material that's, you know, still hanging on there, and that will feed our animals, which will feed their guts, which will then go back to feeding our soil, which will kind of create a tilling-like function on that annual vegetable bed by the hooves of the animal kind of coming through and breaking it up a little bit, or creating little air pockets or seed pockets. And we, you know, we don't do crazy amounts of weeding. We think the weeds have their place in the landscape, and so, you know, we're not out there constantly pulling up the weeds. You know, maybe we'll just kind of cut them down to a height to let the vegetables grow, and the weeds have their function in the landscape. So that's a couple ways of how we treat our annual crops compared, probably a little bit different to some other farmers. Mm,
beautiful. And then if you can share with us what's next for your farms, we're going to say plural, because we hope there are many of them in the future, and what you're calling in right now to support this venture.
Yes, we're very excited, Suzanne, about an upcoming fundraising campaign that will be launching on March 3rd. It's a Kickstarter campaign. We are in the seed round of our funding strategy, so we're asking the public for $30,000 is our goal, and that's going to allow us to get some of the materials we need to get started, specifically some of the electric fencing that's needed to keep these animals in tight bunches to rotate on large pastures to really refurbish grasslands, as well as buying some of those cattle. And so it's going to help us get our start. Once we have a little bit of money in the bank, we can then go apply for other loans, agricultural loans. We're working very closely with the FSA and some members of the of that group to the USDA. Val Docini, the director, he's been great. They have a good beginning young farmers program to help farmers get on their own land and get started. And so that's kind of where we're at right now, and we're reaching out to great folks like yourself to get support from our local Southern California community to prove this new model successful, because we really think it needs to be the future, one that works with nature and builds local communities, surrounds people around their food and where it comes from, and just makes a better future for both ourselves and our kids eventually.
Beautiful. And one point I would love, if you don't mind speaking about, is when you talk about beginning farmers and working with the USDA, and for a lot of people that are going through their own process of understanding what food is, was, and can be, if you could just shine a light on what you hope to see on the horizon for farming, within your local community and within maybe our national and world community, and how you're kind of greeting to or seeing some changes within some of the systems that are already put in place.
Definitely. I think I think it's going to be a very bright future. I really do. I think we need more young people wanting to come back to the land. We need entrepreneurs, who graduate from business schools or who graduate with, history degrees from universities to come back to farming. We need that kind of talent, and I think it will be attractive for those people to come back to the rural agricultural landscapes, because it's a growing field. Our communities need it. We need the love and surrounding and the connection back with our food. And I think more people become aware of really where their food comes from and, eat more organic, and, every story that comes out, that has Foster Farms chicken has salmonella, or another big Tyson food company's, reports this monstrosity with their animals. I think, as more of those stories come out, more and more people are going to be like, what are we doing here? And I can speak for myself, graduating with a business degree from University of San Diego, I really just kind of asked myself, what can I do in this world that I'm passionate about and that this world really needs? And I think it's to fix our agricultural system and encourage people to get more connected with where their food comes from, and actually think about going into this as a career. And there's resources out there for you. I mean, more people are doing this. A lot of young people are coming out into the farming career, and it's still kind of being built out. These support systems, it's not all the way there. You can't just, go out in a year and have your 100-acre farm. You're going to have to do some research and work and build a business plan. But I think, I think a lot of people would really choose this life if they really knew, what it was all about. It's a great life. And I go a lot off what Joel Salatin, farmer out of Swoop, Virginia, says. He's a longtime family farmer, and he gave me a lot of motivation to really start my own farm. And he wrote a book called You Can Farm, and I recommend that for anyone who's looking at a career into farming. It's just a beautiful story of the local food system that he's really encouraging over there, and what he's doing to his land. I just think it's an attractive life, and hopefully, in the not too long near future here, we'll have just abundant functioning local communities where the cities are connected to where their food's coming from, and venturing out to the farms, and the farmers can come in and have a cup of coffee with their with our local businessman at the shop that maybe that they grew the coffee on their farm. Who knows?
Right. Beautiful. Oh, all right. Well, sounds dreamy. And then the other thing I would love for you to address, because, you know, something I didn't completely grasp until I actually was pregnant with my son, that certain people just need to eat different ways. And so being that we're in California and you have every, I mean, this is probably one of the few places on the planet that before you have someone over, you go to someone's house, they might ask you, how do you eat?
it's a big
conversation. And so you have everything from vegan to, eating meat or eating seafood or whatever it might be. And it wasn't until I had my son that I'm not a meat eater, but I craved it. My mom, I had her make it for me. I'd love for you to share just a little bit about that, because I really do believe people need to listen to themselves, like how they need to eat. You shared a little bit, but how you've been able to humanely relate to your animals. I've been in remote villages in like the Philippines where they raise their stock and then they cook it, and it's a different experience. If you can share a little bit, since you have participated, I would appreciate it.
Definitely. I think that's a topic that's very close to my home as well. I think my wife Dina has probably migrated between, you know, kind of three of those main eating habits. You know, she was vegan for a while, and then, you know, was pescatarian for a little while, and then really was starting to crave meat and protein. And so once I started growing it the right way and networking with local farmers who were humanely treating their animals, then she started eating meat. But I definitely think, Suzanne, you really do have to listen to your body. I'm a meat eater, but I really, really focus on where's my meat coming from, what's it doing to the landscape. The one thing I will say is for, you know, kind of the vegetarians and the vegans out there, I support, you know, that decision fully. But I think in terms of an agricultural sense, I really believe that animals are an integral part, especially where we live here in California, to building soils. Their processes, especially on the broad acre landscape of what they can do to a grassland environment and really mimicking the natural processes of these large herds going across. It's just amazing what can be done by bringing animals back into the landscape. And so I think to a certain extent that, you know, the pressure that we created on them from hunting, but also the pressure from the predators that were hunting them, created these large herds that were very beneficial for building soil and for the ecosystem processes. I would say just having a kind of an awareness of that, knowing that animals are important. You may not eat them, you may not, you know, support buying them. I think, you know, most vegetarians are completely right that the majority of the meat that's out there today is just crap. And so, you know, that might be some of their, decision probably to not eat it, or maybe that they just don't agree with eating another, conscious being. But I think, you know, that to just be aware that agriculture really does depend, a good, healthy agriculture does really depend on the right treatment of animals and how you organize them into the landscape. But I definitely agree with them now, you know, the way our cows are being treated and what, the corn crop, 40% of the corn crop's going to feed those animals. I definitely agree that that is not okay, and we need a different model. But just being okay with the fact that some farmers are using the animals to refurbish their landscape, and maybe even some farmers don't eat them themselves, but they realize that animals are so big to building soils and creating a healthy soil environment that they need them. They need them as an agricultural tool. So those are a few of my thoughts there on those topics.
Beautiful. I appreciate that. Yeah. I think it's important for us to consider all things.
Yes.
So
definitely agree.
I just think they're so cute, so I just cannot.
I know.
I'm glad that you can provide them a place to roam, but I do honor my children that definitely are carnivores, so.
Yeah. My wife's the same way. She's like, whenever you're going to slaughter those animals, like, don't let me be there. Like, that's going to be a sad day for her every time that happens. So.
Yeah, well, it's all how it's handled, too. So,
exactly.
So I would love for you to share, we'll put all the links below, but if you can share where to find you guys, and then as soon as the Kickstarter link is up, we'll add that to this link too. So.
Okay, great. That would be great, yeah. It's montadofarms.com, M-O-N-T-A-D-O, farms.com, and then our Kickstarter kind of landing page that we've built that will have, you know, a lot of pictures and a little bit more of an introduction into the campaign is called fundingmontadofarms.com. So,
oh, perfect. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin, I really appreciate you being here today and sharing your wisdom and giving us something to think about and to really welcome back into our ecosystem, especially here in Southern California. So thank you for all that you're doing and will be doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Suzanne. It's a pleasure to be with you and talk with you here today. And thank you for all the work that you do as well.
Thank you. Once again, I want to thank Kevin for joining us today. And if you're inspired, please connect to Montado Farms below their upcoming Kickstarter engagement. And if you have any questions or want to engage with them further, all their contact information is listed below. We're going to sign out with a little Almost There by the album Leaf. Until next time, this is she with a big, big smile, a full heart, soft gaze, and a namaste.